Agatavach. Project Inspire really is about one thing and one thing alone, that is trying to carry out the vision of the Chafetz Chaim and others in terms of us reaching out to Klal Yisrael and bringing Bashiach. That's really what Project Inspire is all about. And the effort is really to give tools to people who otherwise might not take the onus upon themselves to Kiruv because they feel uncomfortable. Because many people will say, I won't know what to answer. Many people will say, I don't have the skills. Many people will say, Echkenish, I just can't do it. It's not for me, I'll leave it to the professionals out there. Now we all understand that there are very few professionals. Meaning there are probably, in the United States of America today, full-time professionals, maybe 500 people who are in Kiruv, full-time. There are many more that are part-time. If you make a cheshbon as to how many Yidden need Kiruv, you're talking approximately 5 million Jews in America who need Kiruv, 5 million Jews in America who are Menutak, who are mamash detached from Yiddishkeit completely, 5 million Jews in America who are over chayv krisis on a regular basis. If you have 500 people who are full-time Kiruv professionals, you do the math. And, you know, each one of them has to be becoming 100,000 people successfully in order to get this done. It's not happening. So this is really responding to a clarion call, and originally if you take a look in Sefer Chaimus Hadas and other Sfarim, that we push it, need to do what we need to do to try to bring Klal Yisrael back. Emir Tashem, in the future sessions, in the three-part series, or the five-part series, we'll spend the first of those sessions literally going through each one of the chiyuvim, each one of the obligations that we have to do Kiruv. And basically the outline was created for us again by the Chafetz Chaim. There's nothing that's new over there. So tonight, in order to catch people's attention, so they put out a very provocative title, Dama Shatoshiv, to be able to answer certain big questions that people have. But before I go into any of those questions, what I'd like to do is I'd like to tell you about an answer that is extremely important for us to have in mind when we're dealing with people who are not yet from. When someone asks you a question, if you're going to get involved in Kiruv, and of course we're talking absolutely without any kind of qualifications that men are to be doing Kiruv with men and women with women, Chas v'Shalom, we're not talking about anything else. But if you ever have a question you don't know the answer to, there's always a good answer, and that answer is I don't know. I don't know is an honest answer, it's a wonderful answer. A lot of Kiruv certainly is about answering people's questions, but I think a lot more of Kiruv is not about answering their questions. It's simply about reaching out and being there for them. I just repeat a story that I heard a while back, and I heard from different parties in the story. Rabbi Wasserman, Rav Simcha Wasserman, lives in the West Coast of the United States of America. He's probably from the earliest Makarvim, the earliest people in outreach in the United States of America. And he, in the late 1950s, he decided he was going to do a Shabbaton. And he went over to a couple that he knew that lived in Southern California, a doctor and his wife, who are not yet from. And he said, listen, you'll invite your neighbors, you invite your friends, invite people in the community, and you're going to do Kiruv. We're going to do Kiruv. We'll have a Shabbaton. Fine. So they're preparing the Shabbaton. Rabbi Wasserman himself comes in a few hours before the Shabbaton, and he comes into the home to inspect the home to make sure everything's set up for the Shabbaton. And he walks in the house, and he goes over to the kitchen, to the stove, the oven, and he asks the lady of the house, he says, where's the chalent? She said, Rabbi, this is Southern California. We don't have chalent in Southern California. There's no chalent. He says, it's Kenner Zayin HaShabbaton on chalent. You can't have Kiruv without a chalent. It's Gagnish. She says, Rabbi, I never made chalent in my life. I don't know how to make it. He says, good. He says, we'll go to the marketplace, and we'll go, I will buy the ingredients, and I'll make a chalent. Not a problem. So Simcha went to the marketplace, and he picked out whatever beans he needed, and potatoes, whatever he needed. And he went, he put it all together, they came into the house, and he set up a chalent. He says, okay, now we're ready for the Shabbaton. The first person they expected to come to the Shabbaton was the next door neighbor of the people who were making the Shabbaton. A woman who's a Holocaust survivor. She comes into the house and she says hello, and she says, good Shabbos, everything's terrific and fine, and they're making small talk, a little bit of banter back and forth. When suddenly the neighbor starts sniffing around and she goes, what's that I smell? So her neighbor says, yeah, I've been watching him and he told me I should make chalent. I should make chalent. She said, what? Chalent, chalent. I'm sorry, I can't stay here. I have to leave. And she got up, she left the house, and she did not come back to the Shabbaton. This was her next door neighbor, one of her closest friends, and she was shocked that the first person that's going to come in is walking away from the Shabbaton. They already failed. Much of Shabbos, after the Shabbaton was over, and it had been a very wonderful Shabbaton, after the Shabbaton is over, the first call that's made, of course, is from the hostess to her neighbor. And she said, what happened? How come you walked out? He said, well, I don't know if you know my story, but I was very severely traumatized. I was very during the Holocaust. I don't even know what really happened to my family except what people told me. Supposedly whatever happened to me and I right in front of my eyes, and I don't even have no recollection. In fact, I was so traumatized that my entire memory of my childhood years are gone. I remember nothing from them. And I've been in therapy for years and years. I've been in hypnotherapy. They're trying to hypnotize me to bring back the memories, because you can't live without a past. And then I walked into your house and I smelled the chalet. And all the memories of my own home started flooding back into my head. And I needed to be alone to sort them out. So when I heard the story from Reb Simcha himself, he said, Rabbi Yitzhai, he said, Klal Yisrael, we all stood by Har Sinai. But we've been through a lot of traumatic events since then. And Har Sinai has been wiped from our memory. But you can't live as a Yid without Har Sinai. It's not Shaita. So people are aimless and they're looking around, they're searching for different things, they latch onto different philosophies. But the emphasis is what they're looking for is their own background, their own past. He said, sometimes all you need is a little challenge, he says. And it's given to taste, you give Kleistel to taste the beauty of Yiddishkeit. A shtickel kugel. You give him a little piece of challah, you show him a recipe of how to make a challenge. And all the memories come flooding back. There's absolutely nothing more important than outreach. It's very good, we're going to talk about how to approach certain questions. We're going to talk about how to deal with certain issues. We're going to talk about that. But there's nothing more important than outreach, than a simple act of caring for one yid for another yid. That's absolutely magical. I just came from New Jersey. I did a Shabbaton in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And the kehillah there, which we all know from years and years ago, of the great Rav Tait, a very large number of the people there who are Bali Tshuva themselves. And I know I'm going to speak here tonight. So over Shabbos, I kept on asking people like how they became from. I'd have to tell you, 90% of the people was because there was somebody who cared enough to reach out. They didn't know the answers. It wasn't the point. The point was that they had some bridge of connection back to Yiddishkeit. And that is the most critical and vital thing we could do. So yes, we're going to speak about certain issues, certain questions that are written down here for me, which you haven't even looked at yet, and certain questions that you're going to ask me, Mirtz Hashem. But ultimately, what's most important is we have to remember it is the physical contact that needs to take place. And we have to make opportunities for that. And Amir Hashem, if you'll sign up for the 3 to 5 part series, Be'ezer Hashem, we're going to go through very hands-on Kiruv. Question number one that was given to me here, and I don't know if it came from the crowd or not, or it came just from the staff. How can there be a caring God with so much suffering? How is it possible that there's so much suffering going on? And we know that Kadosh Baruch Hu is a Toiv, he's a Meitiv. Kadosh Baruch Hu, so what's the pshat that there's so much suffering in the world? And by the way, this does bother a lot of people. So Noach Weinberg says something which is really, really brilliant, which is almost an aside to this question. We'll deal with the question in a moment. He once told me, you should know that the biggest atheist Jew has a better conception of what a Kadosh Baruch Hu is about than the most believing Christian. There are no Christians here tonight, right? I don't want to insult anybody. He says, the most distant Jew has a better concept of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam than the frommest Christian. So I said, why? He said, it's a Dabba Pashit. We speak to a Christian about evil in the universe. What do they say? What does a Christian say? Yeah, there's a force of good, there's a force of evil. Yeah, it's all mixed up. It's not a problem. God can do things like that. And they accept it. He says, but a Yid understands that Kadosh Baruch Hu is a Melech Rachaman. He's a Vidu of a Rachaman. And when he sees suffering in the world and he has no answer for it, he'd rather reject the concept and say that Kadosh Baruch Hu is not a Toif. He said, you hear this? He said, now James, we know that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is not, he loves us. So if they don't have a good answer, they'll walk away, but they're not going to conclude that God is not tight. He said, but a guy has no such problem. Concept Yisrael Kedoshim. I want to answer you the question, at least address the question. I'm not going to answer any questions tonight, really. We're going to address questions. We're not going to answer questions. To answer questions is very presumptuous, because there are a lot of people that no matter how you answer the question, it's not an answer for them. Because they need the question. They have to hang on to that question for dear life, because that's what gives them license to live their lives the way they do. But how to address the question is more important. So the question really is why do bad things happen to good people? Meaning, how can there be a caring God with so much suffering? It's the same question. Why do bad things happen to good people? About 8 years ago, I did a discovery seminar in Denver, Colorado. And at that time, we had about 300 people in the crowd, and we were teaching them about Amita Satayra, teaching them about Ashkaf, Amunah. It was beautiful. We have a session sometimes during long weekend discovery seminars called Stump the Rabbi. It's a little lighter, you know, people ask questions, Stump the Rabbi, see if you can trip up the rabbi. And it's exciting for people. The people who like the seminar like the session. The people who hate the seminar love the session. So I'm sitting there, I'm fielding questions from people. And they're throwing out different questions. And Baruch Hashem, I've dealt with them over the years, feeling quite comfortable. And suddenly, a 16-year-old boy raises his hand and he asks me a question. And he stumps the rabbi. He says, Rabbi, why do I have such a rotten and miserable life? I said, I'm sorry. What seems to be the matter? He says, my mother, she's nuts. I said, okay, I know a lot of 16-year-olds who would feel that way. What, tell me what's so special about your mother. She feels nuts. She says, no, my mother's really crazy. When I was 3 years old, the state came in and sued my mother, took me away from her. Because you see, my body was covered with cigarette burns. When I was 10, they gave her a lawyer for free and she countersued. And she got me back. And it's been 6 years now and every single day has been a living Gehenna. Why did God do this to me? Standing in front of 300 people, I look up and say, Hashem, why are you doing this to me? Like, what am I supposed to say now? There was a time I was quite close to the great tzaddik Rav Shalom Mordechai Kohen Shvadron, the Maggid. There was a time when he used to come to America, he would stay by Rabbi Krohn's house, I would drive him around. So I once asked him, I said, Rebbe, what do you do if you're up there in public? At that time I was already speaking in public. And someone asks you a question, you don't know the answer. So Rav Shalom told me, he said, I'm a meit abisa l'shem shemayim. If you have a little bit of l'shem shemayim, if you're a little altruistic, then you should know that Rabbi Shalom is going to send you the idea of v'al dubistach ha-shliach tzibur. And the shliach tzibur gets siyata d'shemayim, gets help from a kaddish b'chol. That's what he told me. And I'm standing there in front of 300 people, I said, Rabbi Shalom, now would be a good time. And a machshava fell into my head. I turned to the young man, I said, I can't tell you why bad things happen to you. I don't even know why bad things happen to me. I'm not good at this. Number two, I have a mitzvah not to interpret whatever you did, Lara. I have a mitzvah, b'tzedek tishpat amisecha. Now, I'm not going to tell you what you did wrong. I'm supposed to interpret whatever you do for the right, for the correct. So that's not, I can't help you with that. Number three, I said, if there's any way that I can do anything practical to help you, just let me know and I'm asking you. But number four, and I said, I think this will be the most important to you. If 25 years from now, I walked into Eichler's, and Eichler's had replaced all the 60 or 70 titles in their front window with a single book, 200 copies of the same best-selling book. And the name of the book was How to Stop Child Abuse Forever. I would be the last person in the world to be surprised that it had your name on it and its author. And you never would have written the book if it hadn't happened to you. The Rebbe Yishlam has very high expectations from us. Last week, we read in the parasha, he asked Avram Avinu to kill his only son. Es bincha, yechidcha, asher havta. It didn't make it easy, right? According to some, he says that made it a little easier, but since it's a whole pshat. But if you think about it, the Rebbe Yishlam does not shy away from us for big nisyonai. But what's the outcome? The outcome of Akedah Yitzchak is that to this day, every single day, thousands, hundreds of thousands of Yidden start their davening with Akedas Yitzchak. And we ask for that chus to be Megan for us, and it is Megan for us. It has changed the history of Klal Yisrael and the world forever, Akedas Yitzchak. But the Rebbe Shem doesn't shy away from asking us to do it. Avraham Avinu could have been forgiven if he got depressed after Rebbe Shem asked him to do that. But he went ahead and he did it. Now look at the chus we have today. Many of us have challenges. When we face challenges that we think we can't handle, we like to give up. And in the process of giving up, we get frustrated and upset. And we have all kinds of questions, all kinds of terumas. I'm not saying when someone has a difficult challenge in their life that you walk over to them and tell them, it's not the pshat, it's a difficult challenge. It's Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to bring you to greatness with this. You're going to become mamish. It's not the time to tell them that because they can't hear at that point in time. At that point in time, many people need a sympathetic ear. An understanding heart. Someone to be able to vent to a little bit. But the ultimate M is that without challenge, without nisyonos, without difficulty, we do not become the people we're going to become. There's no such thing as attaining any level of godless, any high madrega without a tremendous amount of yigiyah. You didn't become Rav Shach without learning 20 hours a day for how many years? You don't become the Klaizim of Gareba. I have the Talmud and the Klaizim of Gareba sitting here. You don't become the Klaizim of Gareba without going through the Holocaust. And he lost his wife and 11 children. That's not how you become the Klaizim of Gareba. You become the Klaizim of Gareba by going through Nebuchadnezzar's difficulties. And you come out the other end, and how many people he made from the DP camp. Right, at one time I asked him, I was already getting involved in Kirov when I was working for him, and I once asked him about that. I asked him about all the Kirov work he did. I said, "Chagahert as the Rebbe's mamish meisa nefesh given." He was mesiris nefesh to make people from. So he turns to me and says, "Mesiris nefesh?" He said, "Weisach nicht." "Mesiris haguf ya." I said, "What's such mesiris haguf? What's that giving of the guf?" So I'll tell you the truth. He said, right after the war, he said, my back was incredibly painful. He'd been beaten without end by the Nazis. He was treated with such terrible cruelty. He was mamish skin and bones. He was freezing all the time. And right after the war, in the cold of the Polish and the German in the winter, he was able to access an American army jeep, and they took him from DP camp to DP camp to mechazik the people. And he gave people money to put on sheitlach. He gave people to dress sneistic. He did unbelievable work in the camps. So he told me, as he went from camp to camp, he said every bump of the jeep, he mamish thought he was dying all over again. He said the pain in his back from every bump of those hard jeeps, and the jeeps were open, he said the freezing cold, he mamish thought he was going to die. He said that was mesiris haguf. And then he paused for a moment and reflected. He said, no, there was mesiris nefesh also. He said, during some of those trips I didn't dab with a minyan. And I gave up my tefillah b'tzibur to help those people. He says that was mesiris nefesh. Rabbi said, what's really required is Mesiris HaGuf and Mesiris Nefesh. We're asking the questions, we'll address them. There's no such thing as any great thing that happens without some type of challenge or test. People who don't have tests or challenges in life, they just don't become great. They just remain who they are and they don't change. The next question. What about the concept of Chil Hashem from Jews? I think a Jew who willingly makes a Chil Hashem, the stomach is not so frum. But ultimately, sometimes we unfortunately read things in the paper that may not even be true. But the perception is the reality. And you'll hear not yet from people who talk about, what are you talking about? You're going to make me from? From the Yidden Crusade. I see them in the papers. They're doing all these terrible things. There was a time in Boropak a number of years ago where a mother was charged with killing her own child in child brutality. It's a terrible story. And I was in Dayton, Ohio at that time, and they challenged me with that question. They said, what are you talking about? You're talking about Torah being true. If Torah is so emes and it's so true, how could such a thing happen by from Jews? How is a child such a thing? So first of all, we see from here the chaymer inyan of Chil Hashem and how careful we have to be, chas v'shalom, not to get caught up in any kind of Chil Hashem. It's incredibly important. Chil Hashem is certainly not a great outreach tool. But to answer the question, or at least address the question like we like to say, imagine if someone's taking a course in architecture and they're studying the work of one of the world's great architects, Frank Lloyd Wright, name that comes to mind, great architect. So in the class, the professor tells the student, says, listen, there's a building on 145th Street in Harlem. It was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. As a field trip today, I want you to go out, I want you to look at the building and write up a little bit of a report on what you saw. It's fine. The student goes out, he comes to the building, and it's covered with graffiti. And when they pictured the building in class, there are two big lines in front. And the one line, the head was chopped off. The other one was entirely stolen and gone. And the hallway smelled awful. And there was graffiti in the hallways. And the steps were broken. The fine marble columns that had been erected there was totally covered with all kind of garbage. The place is mamish gefrelich. The student comes back to his professor. He's angry at him. He says, what's wrong with you? How could you send me to such a place? It's not a beautiful building. It's mos. It's mias. It's gefrelich. It's ugly. The professor smiles at him. He says, don't you ever blame the architect for what the tenants did to the building. Torah is perfect. Torah is perfect. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us Torah in order to reach and attain perfection. That's what Torah is. Whether you look at the Rambam says it's for me that whatever it is, Torah is mamash perfection in every possible way. Nigla, Nister, it's always perfection. But you can't blame the Rabbeinu Shalom for what the tenants did to the building. Every once in a while we hear things, and first of all, if you just read in the paper, you're not allowed to be mekabel it right away. It's not mochach that it's them, it's just because they write. They write whatever they want to write. But ultimately, even when we do hear stories, which are terrible stories, stories which do pan out to be true, you cannot blame the architect for what the tenants did to the building. It's a wrong thing to do. Torah is taka perfect. Look what Torah did. Torah took the vast majority of the world's population that were oidei avodah zarah, that were polytheists, and it turned them into monotheists. Christians don't claim that they have refined themselves and dropped a lot of avodah zarah to any other reason other than there was an Avraham Avinu. And there was a Yitzchak and a Yankiv. And there was Maimon Har Sinai. Sometimes I wish the Fry Yidden would believe in much as much in Maimon Har Sinai as the Christians do. They believe it's true. They believe it's Emes. The Muslims are pure monotheists. The Mamish pure, they hate the Christians because Christians aren't from enough for them. They're pure monotheists. Where do they get that from? Do you realize that every one of his people, his Elta Zeta, was Mamish, a guy who would worship the rocks and stones and the wind and the fire? How did it come that the vast majority of the world's population turned itself completely around, and the people they loved to hate anyway, the Jews, he said, you know, you were right all along. Because Torah is perfect. Torah is going to have an ashpah on the world. If we just do what we need to do, and we do Torah and keep our mitzvahs, we mind our own business, and we worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu the way we're supposed to, the world comes around. The world comes around. But ultimately, Torah is perfect. Torah is perfection. If you want to look at it and find gematrias, it's perfect. If you want to look at it for pshat, look at Rashi, it's perfect. If you look at the Ramban, it's perfect. If you want to look at the Kabbalah, it's perfect in every way. There's perfection in Torah at every level. People talk about intelligent design in the universe that points to the fact that there's a creator. Intelligent design in Torah is absolutely awesome. It's awe-inspiring. And how many different disciplines Torah stands up to examination? That there's some people in the world that has a class of citizenry that dedicate themselves by the hundreds of thousands to nothing but study Torah. It's absolutely, and Torah stands up to it. Look at all the chedushim that are out there. Look at the svarim they write. Look at the beauty that comes about as a pasuk of Torah. Starts with a pasuk of Torah. Look what comes out. Ganshat. All of Medrash. All of the Zayir. Everything is Torah. Torah is mamash perfect. But you can't blame the architect for what the tenants do to the building. Next question. Someone who's not yet from might say, you know, I'm happy the way I am. What do I need Torah for? Leave me alone. I'm happy. I'm living. What do I need Torah for? Yeah. It's a very good question. About 15 years ago, a book came out. The name of the book was it Final Exit? Anyone remember the name of the book I'm talking about? Sorry? Forgot the name of the book. I think it was called Final Exit. The book sold hundreds of thousands of copies upon its publication. It made the bestseller list of the New York Times. Final Exit was the name of the book. What's the premise of the book? 101 ways to commit suicide in the comfort of your own home. When it came out, the book cost $25, the same price as an illegal handgun on the streets of New York at that time. So you have to wonder, who bought this book? Manavshach. If you're not miserable, you don't buy the book. But if you are miserable, don't buy the book, buy the gun. Like, why buying the book for? So what's the terrorist? The vast majority of people in the world are not happy. Happiness is so elusive that years ago, Newsweek magazine dedicated a cover of one of its issues, seeking the Galileo of happiness. They're looking for the breakthrough of happiness. That's what the cover said. Looking for the next breakthrough, the next genius thing in happiness. The world, Rabbi says, is not happy. When people run around in life who are not happy, it could be they're not ready to do it today, but maybe the day they are ready to end their lives, it might be raining outside. They don't want their hair to get frizzy. So you buy the book and you keep it safely in the house just in case. When it comes to happiness, there's a professor, I think it's at Harvard. He's an Israeli guy. He has the largest ever class that people registered for in the history of Harvard University. He has thousands and thousands of students that come listen. What are they talking about? How to be happy. And by the way, a lot of it is based on it, Rav Noach Weinberg's happiness class. And he has endorsed a lot of Eishes Torah programs. That happens to be interesting. He's not, I don't know how from he is or from he's not, I don't know. But I will tell you that that's what he's talking about. Happiness? If someone tells you happy enough already, what do you tell him? Happy enough? What do you mean you're happy enough? If I could show you how to be happy, are you not interested? No, I'm happy enough already. So let me ask you a question. Let's say I showed you how to make some money. I showed you how to make $100,000. And you made the $100,000. I come back 6 months later. I said, you want to make another 25? Nope, I have enough money already. No one would say that. I made $100,000. Make another 25. Ayev kesef liyizba kesef. If you're really a connoisseur of happiness, you always want more. What do you mean I'm happy enough already? Selamite, then you don't want to be happy. But everybody wants to be happy, right? Come, let me show you how. There's no such thing as people are happy enough. If I can show you an insight to be happier, if I could show you how to truly accept yourself for who you are, if I could show you how to love yourself, if I could show you to walk around in life feeling lucky to be alive every second, if I could teach you what the content of the mitzvah of Ahavas Hashem is, if I can teach you to count your blessings and make it part of your nature, you know what you're transformed into? You walk around with a stupid smile pasted on your face every day. You're a different person. You come home at night, you don't growl at your family. Everybody knows there's too much unhappiness in the world. You tell me happy enough already, fine. I'll let me try to get even happier. Because if you're really, really happy and you love happiness, don't tell me you're happy enough. There's no such thing as happy enough. Next question. I'm a good person. I try to do good things in my life. What do I need Torah for? I have my own moral code. What do I need Torah for? There are three places the Torah gives us the choice that we have in life, the central choice in life, the hinge upon which all bechira turns. One place the Torah says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has placed before us bracha and klala. The one place the Torah says it places before us tov and ra. The third place the Torah says chaim and mavis, life and death. And only one of those three places does Torah give us a hint as to which we should want. And you all know the Torah says u'bacharta b'chaim, choose life. The question is why? L'chaira, from a very simplistic overview of Torah, it would seem that Torah is a moral document. And what the Torah is there for is really to tell us what to do, what not to do, what's good and what's bad, good and evil. That's what Torah is about. So l'chaira, if that's what Torah is really about, then why is Torah telling us u'bacharta b'chaim? It's not a health book. It's not a vitamin supplement thing. It's not a holistic Torah is a book about Tov and Ra. B'chata b'toiv. That should be, if there's one signature of a Kadosh Baruch Hu in terms of advice is what to do, it should be b'chata b'toiv. What's taich u'b'chata b'chayim? So the emes is, the Torah telling you Tov and Ra, you don't know what it's talking about. If the Torah says brach and klala, you don't know what it's talking about. The only answer that is a shavah l'chol nefesh that every single person can appreciate and understand is chaim and mavis. Let me tell you why. Let's look at Tov and Ra for a minute. You walked into a room, and one of my rebbeim was sitting there. A guy in Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik v'Kadosh Livracha. And Lahavdil, another person is sitting there. Not really a person, a monster. Adolf Hitler. And you walk into the room, and you say, are you a good person? Who's the first one to stand up and say, yes! Zecher Hitler. So Shiv is a Chayil of Racha probably saying, working on it. Trying to be good. Which kid could say he's good? Tachlis HaTayim, you can't say that, right? Working on it. What's the pshat that Hitler's so sure that he's good? How does Hitler know that he's good? The answer is like this. Whenever people do something that's evil, they don't really mean to do something that's evil. They don't wake up in the morning and say, you know, I think I'm going to do something bad today. They don't do that. You know what they do? They confuse themselves into thinking that that which they wish to do really is good. Sometimes I accompany the Shomrim here when they have a difficult case that involves family discord, fighting within families. Once in a while. They'll call me up. It's a particular difficult situation. I know I work with youth at risk. So sometimes they'll take me along in the car. I come into a house and I see this young lady. She's screaming at her mother and using language that's mamash kefirla. And she's mamash yelling at the mother. So I'm not an outsider. I'm allowed to say whatever I want, right? So I come into the house. I say, excuse me? What do you think you're doing? And the young lady looks at me and she says, you don't understand. She's got it coming to her. I said, let me get this right. She's got it coming to her, and therefore you're the one that has to get it to her because you're raising her, right? We never do something bad. We confuse ourselves into thinking that it's good. We make crazy excuses. Right? You catch a bank robber red-handed with the money. You say, why did you do it? You never heard him say, because I'm a bad man. And I needed to do something bad. You know what you hear? You say, hey, I've got kids to put through college just like that bank president. I'm just taking what's coming to me. Let me say that. You know the story about the fellow, the United States Senator, who's walking the streets of Washington, and he's accosted by a mugger. And the mugger sticks a gun in his ribs and he says, give me your money. Senator says, you know who I am. And the mugger says, I don't care who you are. Just give me your money. He says, I happen to be your senator. He says, okay, give me my money. People always justify. The more evil an act is, the more people go to tremendous lengths to justify what they're going to do. Because people are always justifying, because the human being has a tremendous need to think that he's not bad, that he's doing the right thing. How did Hitler justify the murder, the butchery of 6 million of ours? How did he do it? Very well. He wrote a book called Mein Kampf. And Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote the following. Everyone knows that the worst scourge that's ever visited the world, the worst curse that's ever visited the world, is the Jews. Everyone knows that. And I'm going to relieve the world of this problem. And he writes, and this is a quote translated from the German, I am the redeemer of mankind. Not that he's not bad. He's the Mashiach. Because to do something so evil, he's got to come up with a really dramatic justification. And the only thing he could find was to be the Mashiach. One person's good is another person's evil. The people who blew up the Twin Towers on 9/11, they really thought they're doing absolutely wonderful work. They're doing God's work. That's what they thought for sure. So you tell me good or evil, I don't know what you're talking about. One man's good is another man's evil. She'll say, Baruch Hashem Kalala, blessing and curse, right? Nope. The last 3 or 4 years, once a week I go into a drug rehab center to work with from kids from from homes, I should say, who are in rehab for drug addiction. And I've met out of hundreds of kids already like this. And almost every one of them has a story that's similar to the one I'm going to tell you. It's a variation upon the same theme. Almost every one of them. Very dramatic. They say, Rabbi, there I was. My parents threw me out of the house. I had stolen all the money I could from my friends already, and they threw me out as well. I had no place to go. I'm living on the street for 2 weeks. Had a shower in 10 days. And I'm laying on the floor, and I can't afford my drug anymore. So I'm sitting there in the cold, and I'm shivering. And suddenly, my drug dealer walks by. He looks at me, and he takes pity on me. He puts his hand in his pocket, and he throws me a bag of something, and he says, hey, this one's on me. He says, Rabbi, at that point, I was mamishing Gan Eden. Funny, because it sounds like he was mamishing Gan Eden. It's very relative. Torah says, b'charta b'bracha, you don't know what it's talking about. At that point, for that guy, that was a bracha. The only thing that Shavu L'chol Nefesh is b'charta b'chayim. There are things that you could do in your life that are life-enhancing, that make quality of life better, that make the life of people around you better, that improves the entire world. It's a tikkun for everything. And that's being consistent with the Dvar Hashem. There are things in life, Chas V'Shalom, that are self-destructive. There are things that diminish your life, diminishes the lives of other people around you, and that's called mavis. Sukta Tairo, Bacharta Bachaim, everybody can understand that. Things that are truly good are things that are life enhancing. There have been many societies that invented their own good. The Romans invented their own good. They created a concept of peace. In Latin it was called Pax Romana. Those of you who went to school and actually studied might remember that the Roman version of peace was the following. Either give up to us, they would send a message to a country, give up to us, or we take you over. It's very simple. That's Roman peace. Either give up, as though we conquered you, or we're going to conquer you. That's all. It's called Roman peace. Great idea, by the way. Fantastic idea. Tremendous progressive idea in terms of globalization and world peace, the world understanding, United Nations. Terrific idea, right? Many nations have built new systems of justice. And every single one of them, without exception, failed. Do you have any idea how many Yidden were verkauft to communism? Do you have any idea how many Yidden were communists? This was going to bring equality to everybody. The accident of your birth had absolutely no bearing as how you were going to be treated by the state. Nirvana, this Mamash Gan Eden. Years ago, there was a Yid who managed to come out of Moscow. His name was Rav Levine. Rav Levine was the chavrusa of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz Zichron Livracha between the two world wars. Early when Mir Yeshiva was mamish like a shtibel, he learned with Rav Chaim Shmulevitz chavrusa. So this Rav Levine was a rav in a shul in Moscow. And the late 1940s, early 1950s, he gave a drasha criticizing the communist government. And he said, It was Parshas Bereishis. He spoke about the concept of Gan Eden. And he asked his congregants, he said, "Vos for a Gan Eden is Shengeven, that you have to stand in line for an hour for a piece of bread." Because the communists always said that they were creating the workers' paradise. That's what they said. He said, "What kind of a paradise do you have to stand for a piece of bread?" He was in jail for 10 years for that. They had a system. You don't think they had a system? This fellow Stalin talked about the creation of a new human being. We know a human being in Latin is called Homo sapien. He said the new human being would be called Homo sovieticus, the Soviet man. He would be a better person. He'd be terrific. And the whole country goes crumbling like a house of cards 70 years later. There's not a system, not an ethical system, not a moral system that ever, ever, ever succeeded in the world. There's no such thing. Except for one, the Torah. And Adayim is there. Countries that base their judicial system are based upon Torah. To an extent, ours is one of them. To an extent, limited extent. Have some sort of a kiyum. But those that don't. You cannot be a good person. What is good? You know what we understand is good? Something that you do which is concentric with the will of Hashem, that's good. That has a kiyum. The Dvar Hashem is nitzav. It lasts forever. But something which goes anti-Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Bayre Yoylam, Kadosh Baruch Hu is the Bayre Yoylam. He gives life, he creates life. You're going counter the creation of life, you're going to have a kiyum. There can be no such thing. Every moral system in the history of the world has failed. It's been a miserable failure. Do you really, really think that the Nazis were idiots? They were far from idiots. They created a system. But eventually, even that system collapsed upon itself, despite the fact that they were able to get such passion and such passionate devotion from the people, and they had superior technology, and they did. But it collapsed in the end. You start up with the Rabbanu Shlom, you're going to collapse. Ultimately, anything that we do which is consistent with the Dvar Hashem, that has a kiyum, that has a nitzchias. Anything we do that not is not nitzchias, it's going to be bottled at some point in time. There's a saying in the South, when somebody engages in a very futile endeavor or activity, they said, "Oh, him, what he does is like spitting in the wind." What happens when you spit in the wind? Your children, it's right back in your face. If there is a Bayri Olam and he has some direction for the universe, you tell somebody, and this is what he wants to do, and you're going to go against it, you're spitting in the wind. But on the other hand, if you recognize that there's a Bayri Olam and he has a certain direction, and if you make choices in your life that are consistent with where he's going to, Hashleich al Hashem Yahavka v'hu yachavka lecha. If there's some direction of Bayri Olam is going and you want something to be done, and you hitch your wagon kevyachol to his, then you cannot not succeed. Batel ritzoinchom ipnei ritzoinoi, kideshi batel ritzoinachirim ipnei ritzoinecha. Nullify your will before the Rabbi Shlomo's will. He'll nullify the wills of others before your will. So if you look at the Rav, the Bartanur right there, he says, it's a kinoi. This is not really what it means. Not that he's going to be about the other side, it's kevayachal, his ratzon. He's going to do what you want. Because ultimately your goal and purpose is to see Hashem's will done. Then how could you fail? If Rabbi Shlomo's behind you, you're going to fail? I have to tout our own horn here a little bit. So Shiva Veshatayr of Noach Weinberg, he decided at some point he wanted to do Kiruv. Came from America, Teretz Yisrael, he's learning in the Mir in Yerushalayim, and decided he wants to do Kiruv. So he's learning, sitting and learning, but he has this idea, and it's a whole different idea, and he's going to go about Kiruv differently. What he's going to do is he's going to take a few Balei Tshuva, he's going to make them take a few American guys who are not from, turn them into Balei Tshuva, then he's going to set them free to do Kiruv with other people. And as effective as Yeshiva people are going to be, he feels these people are going to be more effective. They don't want to speak the language of the not yet from. You can't just open up a place like this, yeshiva like this on your own. That's the Rebbe. The Rebbe, his Rebbe was Reb Lazy Yudafinkel, Rashiva Mir Yeshiva. He comes to Reb Lazy Yudafinkel, he says, "Rosh Yeshiva, I got this idea." He says, "What's the idea?" "I'm going to take American boys who are not from. I'm going to make them from. Then I'm going to train them to do Kiruv. They're going to go out and they're going to stop assimilation because I can't sleep at night. There's terrible assimilation in America." So Reb Lazy said, "Haste us, du willst machen a Fabrik of Balei Tshuva. You want to make a factory for Balei Tshuva." He said, "Yeah." He says, "Du bist am Meshugene. It cannot be done. Gaze it to learn." 6 months later, he's got this idea burning in his head that he wants to do it. So he comes back to Rashiva. He says, "Rosh Yeshiva." He says, "You don't understand. There are people that are assimilating in America. Echad Yishay Gezach, I told you already. Gaze it to learn." 6 months later, he comes back. He says, "Rosh Yeshiva, I got to do this. So Shiva said, "Du halst das, du kennst das, Tom. You think you can accomplish this?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "Oy bazoy," he took out a check, and money was very scarce in those days. They gave him a check. He says, "Go do it." He says, "Valas du willst das, will das der Rebbeinu Shalom Zicher." The Rebbeinu Shalom Zicher wants it. Rabbi said, "The Rebbeinu Shalom wants his children back." He does. He wants his children back. There's no question about it. You know, those of us who sit and do Tikkun Chatzos at night, L'chaira, Halacha Shulchan Aruch, I don't know why the Olam doesn't do it exactly. I'm not saying I do. Just saying, but not knowing so much. So if you look at the simple, how to do Tikkun Chatzos, to cry over the Churban Beit HaMikdash, it says before that you're supposed to cry over the Hizbailus of Yidna. Yidna went away from Yiddishkeit. That's one of the things you're supposed to cry over. That's what we're supposed to cry over. We're supposed to be Mishtatev with the Tsar of the Shekhinah. The Tzeishtei, take a look at it. And Shekhinah is crying every day over his children. My friend Yaakov Solomon says, why is it that it's happening today, Nebuch, that so many people have children go off to Derech? And there are many other things to talk about as to the why. But he said, but forget all the whys and all the psychological reasons and all the insights. It's a Tzavah Pashat, he said. When Chalila, one of our children, goes off, it hurts us. What do you think it's like for their Rebbeinu Shalom with so many of his children? When 10% of his children are close to him and 90% of them are gone. How does it feel to the Bari Island? The Rebbeinu Shalom willed us. The Rebbeinu Shalom wants his children back. If the Rebbeinu Shalom wants his children back, all we need to do is be there. So I know I went away from the question. I'm really good. So what is the answer is, good is consistent with the will of the Bari Island. If you want to do a thing that's good, that is your own kind of good, it doesn't mean it's good. Good is simply defined as what is considered with the build of the Bari Olam. Good that you happen to think that somehow fits in with a certain society's opinions. The Germans were also a society. The Nazis were also a society. And they determined that Jews were evil and they were good. So if just I tell you good and evil, you don't know what I'm talking about. There are many questions that people are terrified of when it comes to creation questions versus science. And to some people it can be very terrifying questions. I'd like to make a couple of statements here that I think that hold true and are very important to realize. The Torah is not a book on science. The Torah is unlimited. Aruka Mi'aretz Midah. The Torah is the Dvar Hashem, which has unlimited meaning and unlimited insight. And science ultimately is always blinded by and limited to its own instruments to be able to see things. And so when science narrowly interprets something to mean a certain thing, there's no question in my mind that it may have scientific validity. But scientific validity is not cast in stone. Scientific validity really, to some extent, just means that there's someone out there waiting to write a book tomorrow that's going to destroy the hypothesis of today. That's what science is. Now, when we find a kasha in Torah, we go, "Oy vey, I don't understand the kasha." When someone else finds a kasha in science, I go, "Great, I can write a new book." And that's the emes. That's the way it is in science. So, lemaisus, when people ask about contradictions, seeming contradictions between science and Torah, the question doesn't really begin. It's not something clearly that is a kasha in Torah. And when Torah says something, it's not even a kasha in science. Science will admit to you that they're limited. They're limited by their perceptions, by their instrumentation. So, ultimately, when people come along with questions, when people come along with issues, and it seems to be that their irreconcilable differences are not shayach, we have to remember that we're dealing with amitas ha-Torah. Torah is not meant to give you, it's not limited to science. Torah is emes. Emes is a lot bigger than science. I want you to know, when I was a child, and Rabbi Hillel Davidson will be able to point this out to me, when I was a child, he told me, he said, "You remember, how old did those apikorsim say the universe was?" They said 100 billion years. That's what they said. Today, you know what they say? 15 billion years. So David Shlita told me, he says, "You know, they're coming much closer to our point of view in a real hurry. Because the distance between 100 billion and 15 billion is a lot greater than the distance between 15 billion and 6,000. And that's the way it is in science. And you know what? They don't say, "You know what? Throw out the science! How could you go for 100 or 15 billion? Sakasira!" They don't say throw out the science. They live with it. It's okay. The emes is that when it comes to issues of science and Torah, any intelligent person with just a little bit of background and more important, with confidence, with emunah and betachin, understands that science is necessarily limited. It's blinded by its instrumentation. And I'm not saying that scientifically Meneo-based things are wrong. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying science as a whole doesn't know what it's talking about. For example, for years and years they were arguing about how light travels. Does it travel in waves? Does it travel in particles? Did you know that? So for years and years and years, they proved definitively that it travels in waves, and since it travels in waves, it cannot be in particles. That was the end of the story. So another guy proved that it was both. You understand? It's a judgment, because that's what science does. Science is a human attempt to try to understand the universe. Well, guess what? Humans are flawed, and humans are going to make mistakes. And the only problem with science is, when you see that something is wrong, is how quickly you can publish a new book and make more money on the absolute newest theory. So ultimately, what we have to have is emunah betachin, and to know that the Dvar Hashem is nitzav l'olam v'ed, the Dvar Hashem is permanent, and it's not a reflection upon what science is supposed to say. Science obviously has nothing to say about what Torah is all about. So ultimately, the question doesn't even begin. And now I'd like to take some questions from you. Not all at once, please. Don't yell out. How do you begin by having people come to you for Shabbos meal? We're going to cover a lot more in the 3 to 5 part series. We keep saying 3 to 5 part series, I'll tell you why. I just want to explain that for a moment. Initially, Project Inspire was created to create a 3 part series. But it never stays a 3 part series because the people are always demanding more and more and more. Which, by the way, shows you something about the program. But we'll talk about that. You're absolutely correct in saying, how do you invite someone to Shabbos? I don't even know them. You know what New Yorkers are like. We don't talk to each other. We have 50 New Yorkers crowded in an elevator in a skyscraper in Manhattan. What are all the people doing in the elevator? Looking at the numbers. Don't you think they looked at the numbers before? When they finish looking at the numbers, look at the ceiling. Like they never noticed there was a ceiling fan there before. Then they look at the floor and see if it's carpet or tile. I don't know where they're looking, right? Because we studiously avoid making eye contact with each other. Am I right? Absolutely correct, right? So how is it shy if you get to the point where someone's going to come tell you Shabbos, you don't even talk to them? And the answer is, you've got to talk to them. You've got to say hello, how are you? If you have a neighbor out there, but not a Shem Shabbos. You say good morning. If somehow a piece of mail has got lost on the sidewalk near your house, you pick it up, you knock on the door, you bring it back, say hello, how are you? You see them carrying a package, you help them with a package. If they're an elderly Jew, you stand up for them, you help them out. They're Isa, by the way. The things that you have to create a point of connection. You're absolutely right. You can't go from not saying hello to having them trust you that you're not going to poison them when you bring them into the house. You might be one of those crazy Jews, those militants. You know, we're full of militants. Jews are very, very frightening people. Right? When was the last time you saw, like, Goyim walking on the street and say, oh no, there's 2 Jews, let me get out of here, right? But somehow, they think we're very militant and very extreme people. So ultimately, you have to make a point of connection. You have to say, hello, how are you? How many Yidden came out of the former Soviet Union in the last 20 years who live today in New York City? Tens of thousands. And then people tell me, I don't have anybody to invite. Anybody to do it? People at Baropath always tell me, there's no one to be Makarov. Every time I park by an apartment building, I hear Russian all the time. And they don't look from to me. Right? So, of course, you have to create a point of connection. You have to create an opportunity to be able to invite. How do you do that? By saying hello. By saying Shalom Aleichem to another Yid. Absolutely. The Inyan is Yagdim Shalom, a person has to be Magdim Shalom, Lechol, what does it say? Anyone remember? Chol Yisrael Adam. Adam. Adam doesn't say it, Israel. You say hello. You say hello. If those of us remember of Avigdor Miller, Zichron Lebracha, you all remember, you walk in the street, always said hello. Said hello to everybody. Hello is a great opportunity to get to know somebody. Just to say hello. Yes?
How do you suggest to appear in a place when you have to keep a professional kind of relationship?
It's not an easy question. I'm not suggesting that there's a chiyuv for anyone to lose their jobs over doing kiruv. But what I would like to say is, within the confines and the limitations of what you have, we're still obligated to do what it is that we can do. I find, by the way, very often when I speak to people who are in professional environments, they will tell me that not only are they able to do kiruv, but those not yet from Yidden come over to them. Typical scenario. You're standing at the water cooler, filling up a cup with water. The guy comes over to you and he says, Shalom! What's he doing? He's clearly identifying himself. Ich bin ein Chayit. I'm a Jew. Isn't that what he's saying? Or he say, oh, I went to a bar mitzvah last night. You know, it was great. You know, the cake was fantastic. Right? whatever they say. They're literally calling out to you and asking you to be makar of them. I'll tell you a quick story. A number of years ago, I was riding the subway to Manhattan, and at Prospect Park or so, 7th Avenue, Prospect Park, it was, I don't even know what line is anymore. It used to be the B and the Q and the B. It gets all very confused in my head. And a fellow gets on my car. This is a number of years ago when Lubavitch Rebbe was not well. And he sits down next to me. And the subway at the time, I used to prepare my chumash because I didn't have any of the quiet time. Baruch Hashem, even the cell phone doesn't work there. So I'm sitting there preparing my chumash. This guy sits down next to me. The whole car is empty, mind you. The entire car is empty. This guy sits down right next to me. At some point, the train starts moving. He turns to me and says, "So tell me, how's the Rebbe?" I think he mistook me for a Lubavitch. The claim said, "Yeah, I could be accused, maybe, you know." So I say, "I understand he's not well." He says, "Yeah, I know. He says, "You know, during the intermediate days of Passover, they had this prayer vigil outside his room in the hospital." He says, "I went." I said, "Oh, that's nice." I go back to my machumash. He says, "Prayer," he says, "prayer is a wonderful thing," he tells me. "You know, you don't have to be religious to pray. It's a very interdenominational thing," he says. "It's part of the Judeo-Christian tradition." When he put those two words together, I closed the chumash and said, "Now we got what to talk about." So he started schmoozing. I said, "You know, when you put those two words together, one would think that it's really they agree on everything, but in fact, it couldn't be further apart." He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, for instance, in Judaism, we believe that everybody has a portion of the world to come. Everybody goes to heaven." He said, "Real?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Do you ever say Kaddish for a parent?" He says, "Yeah." "So my father died 20 years ago," he says, "and I said Kaddish for him." "How long did you say the Kaddish?" He said, "11 months. I said, "Why not 12 months? He said, "Gee, I don't know." I said, "The first yard side is 12 months. That's the next, you know, milestone in the memory of your father. Why did you start 11 months?" So I explained to him, because even the worst offender only goes to the bad place only for 12 months. And we don't want to indicate as though our parent is the worst offender. And that's why we stop, because of Kibbutz Avim. We stop at 11 months. To indicate they're not the worst, but if it's after that period of time, everybody goes to heaven. Everybody goes to heaven." So yeah, okay, so what? I said, "What do Christians believe?" He says, "I don't know what they believed." I said, "They believe the only way to be redeemed, which means to go to heaven, is to believe in that guy. Otherwise, everyone goes to the other place." I said, "Christians believe that the entire humanity was designed to go to the bad place unless they find that guy, and then they're redeemed. Judaism believe everybody goes to heaven. They believe everybody's going to the other place. You tell me they're the same?" He said, "That's unbelievable. Why would it be that way?" I said, "Because in Judaism we believe in a kind and loving God." He said, "That is so beautiful," he tells me. "I want to know more. No one ever told me that." So I was sitting, you know, my stop came up at 47th Street, and I put my hand in my pocket. I had a card. I said, "Listen, you want to know more?" And I gave him the card. I carry a few cards. This card I gave him happened to say Eshet Torah on it. And as a result of this, he calls up Eshet Torah. And for a period of 2 years, I was tracking him. He didn't miss a single week that he didn't come to learn. You got to just be open to it. You know, when in the workplace, someone comes over and they want to tell you something, there's no crime, by the way, against making up and talking to the guy after work. But yeah, if you come into work and you act like a missionary, which, by the way, is always a terrible thing to do, we're not missionaries. And you come as a decent human being, and you show respect to a person, and you don't crowd his face too much, and you don't stalk him, you don't make him crazy, but you do it nice, you give him some information that he wants, utilize some of the instruments that Project Inspire has created, which, by the way, are fantastic, tapes and books, it's just very informative. No one's going to accuse you of harassing someone else on the job, but you should be conscious and aware and follow the rules. Yes, any other questions? Yes, sir. Yes, a little louder. Crazy people. Yeah, so the question is, what if someone says, "I have my brand of Judaism, you know, it's Reformed Judaism, and that's what it's all about." So there are a couple of things that you have to really put into context in terms of history, but we don't know much history, unfortunately. But when did Reform start? Does anyone know? 1830s, 1840s in Germany. When did Reform start? What was Reform before that? It wasn't, which is to say that for several thousand years, every single Jew in the universe believed that the only way that you can be Jewish and practice your Judaism is by believing in Amitas HaTorah, by believing in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and by keeping Tag Mitzvah. Am I right? Right. Okay. So what did happen at that point in time? Some people decided that really you can change the rules and you can go back and do whatever you want to do or revise whatever happened before you. Am I right? Okay. But you would agree with me that what I am therefore is not really Orthodox. Orthodox is the crazy name given by the Reform to the people who still practice to show that they're extremists. So therefore, would you admit that I'm a classical Jew? I'm a classical Jew, and you're practicing something that's pretty brand new. You know, it's pretty like only 100 years old. Would you admit to that? So clearly you have defanged his question, because it's quite clear that you didn't make something up that happens to be extremist, but you're the genuine article, and they're trying to make a change. Now I go a step further. Imagine you're playing a game of baseball with your friends. You're playing still, playing a game of baseball. And what happens is that some big thugs come around who are bigger and stronger than you are, and they say, we want to play with you. You say, okay, you can play with us. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're going to beat you up if you don't let them play with you. They want to play. We challenge you to a game. Fine. Say, okay, challenge to a game. Absolutely no problem. They said, one thing though. Instead of three strikes and you're out, we hold four strikes and you're out. You look at them, they're big, they're tough, they're mean. You say, okay, four strikes, you're out. No problem. Say, no, one more thing they say. It's not three balls, or it's not four balls a walk, it's two balls a walk. Okay, two balls away. The bigger the story, the better. They say, oh, you don't play in a diamond, you play in a circle. And by the way, there's no bases. Throw wherever you want to play. They say, you say to them, listen, you're a nice guy. You know, I don't mind playing with all of that. And I'll play this game with you. Just do me a favor and don't call it baseball. You got it? That's the answer.